supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Efforts to peer all the way back in time and space are the focus of a team of scientists from around the world now convening in Philadelphia. Joining me to learn more about the scope of the project is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, what sort of telescope can take us all the way back to the beginning?
It's unlike any other telescope you've ever seen before, I'm sure. In fact, if you were to see it, you might not even recognize it as a telescope, except that it points up, and that's a good start. But we have with us today a small team from the research group that's using this telescope that hopes to be able to discover new information about the very earliest time of the universe. And so joining us here in the studio today, we have Jack Orlowski-Scherer, Renee Elajek, and we have Casey Wagner, all part of that same team. Welcome, folks. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
We're glad you could be here. Now, while we understand that you're here in Philadelphia, as Dave said, to meet with everybody that's on your team working on this particular telescope of the Simons Observatory, I wonder if you could take a minute just to tell us about that project.
Sure. The Simons Observatory is a really ambitious project, bringing people from all around the world together to work on the designing and actually building this telescope in the deserts of northern Chile in the Atacama, to try and understand what the universe was like really in its infancy and how it changes with time. We're starting to really come up with a plan of how the site needs to be built and what we need to understand about the instruments. And it's really great to be in the same room arguing about all the details and really designing the most efficient and most precise telescope that we can build. Because there's a lot we still don't understand, and that's why it's so exciting. We don't know exactly what the conditions were at this inflationary time, this very early time. And so we're looking for signs and signals of particular types of physics that can happen, which makes it so exciting.
Jack, what does she mean by inflation?
Inflation is a period in the very early universe where the fabric of space-time expanded exponentially fast. So many, many, many times over in a period of a fraction of a second. That theory would solve many problems that we have in astronomy, but we don't have any direct validation of the theory of inflation yet.
Casey, would it, though, create other problems in the course of solving many?
I don't know how to answer that without making some people mad and making some people happy, I guess.
Oh, that sounds good. Let's do that.
No, I don't know all of the issues that could or could not be solved, but what I do know is that as Simons Observatory, we want to go out and make the best measurement we can and then use the measured data that we have to let people to try and interpret that data and build their theories or refine their understanding based on the data that we have from these good measurements.
From what Derek has taught me, that's spoken like a true scientist.
Well, but it's actually, you know, Casey has a great point because it's really bringing together people who do very different things. You know, I don't work on the actual hardware or the detectors, but I'm very interested in saying, okay, what can the new measurement tell me about theories of dark matter? And so we play this dance together where I say the measurements have to be this precise, otherwise I can't tell the difference between two types of dark matter. And Casey says, well, okay, but actually we can only get the detectors so cold, so how can you do? And so as we start building the telescope, it's really about the theorists and the experimental scientists working hand in hand so that we don't just get something that nobody ordered.
I'm an instrumentalist, so I work on the specifics of the design of one of our instruments in particular. I don't also have time to become an expert in the theory, so we have the theorists who can tell us this is the science that we think is the most fruitful, and then a lot of what we do is translating those requirements into a design for the instrument.
Also, I think one thing to make clear, I think, is that Simons Observatory is truly an observatory, and that is we're not just one telescope. We're actually going to be, currently, the plan is to have four telescopes, one large one, and then three smaller telescopes with the idea that we can tackle different science goals. We want to learn about the very beginnings of the universe, but we also want to learn about other things that happened as the universe evolved. And so that's why we're having the different telescopes.
Let's be clear, though. We're using the term telescope, but we're surveying the entire light spectrum, so it's not the visible spectrum that we're honing in on.
So we're actually focusing on microwaves. So, yeah, these are not things that you can see with your eye. And one of the cool things that I wanted to just add about the collaboration, which is quite novel, actually. So I have been part of a collaboration called the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is also in the Atacama Desert. And the Simons Array is a different group of people with a different telescope design, quite close to ours in this very, very cold site. And actually, we decided through this donation from the Simons Foundation to actually join forces. So we're taking two collaborations that have different technologies, different theories, different motivations, and we're putting them together to become the best of both worlds, basically, which is really, really great. And I think it's added a lot of interest and liveliness to both of our groups, because now you've got a whole bunch of new colleagues that you didn't have 6 months ago.
To me, the most interesting thing is really coming as close as we can to finding out about this period of inflation. Whether or not we'll be able to detect it or detect its remnants, that's the thing that to me is really the coolest thing for me personally, just because that's really telling us about some of the beginnings of the universe as we know it.
And again, this period of inflation was merely a fraction of a second?
A fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second.
Were the rules as we know them even in place then? Did it obey, say, the speed of light and have all the elements in place that we know of?
I'll let Renee answer that.
So actually, the elements as we know them then were not in existence. So by the time the universe was a couple of minutes old, we had synthesized a lot of these nuclei, so a lot of the light elements, as we call them. We think that the laws of physics hold, and that's sort of a fundamental assumption. But one of the reasons why inflation is challenging is because the mechanism for inflation, or the mechanism for this period at all, isn't well understood. And some people say, well, because of that, I don't like the theory of inflation, and they try to come up with alternatives, which is completely valid. So we're trying to understand from a theoretical point of view what could have done this, and that's sort of these ripples of inflation that we want to detect with something like the Simons Observatory, some evidence that this happened at all, basically.
This is all fantastic research. It's just fabulous that you're probing these deep recesses of the universe in a very, very early time. What does that mean to the person out on the street? What does that mean to a kid growing up these days?
Well, all of these large, large data sets and developing the models to try to understand them, you know, the statistical models to understand these and analyze the data, these are not things that exist. And so scientists are developing these models, right? And they're learning how to work with these huge, huge data sets. Well, this is the same kind of thing that Facebook is doing, or that finance companies are doing, or that companies all across the globe in all different industries are doing. The tools and skills that we're developing to you know, understand the early universe, those tools are kind of make their way into society in ways that are not transparent always, but that's one particular way.
We've learned so much more about the universe than when I started, and I can just wait and wonder to see what young scientists are going to show me as I get older in this field. It's really, really exciting.
When we now talk about the history of the universe and then focusing so much on this early, early time, are there as many questions about the universe, say, 1 billion years on, or do we have a much better sense of how it's played out?
That's actually a great question. So we look back, because of the speed of light, being finite, when we look back in distance, we're actually looking back in time. But the cool thing is that this light that left the cosmic microwave background, that left the Big Bang, has actually been traveling through the universe to get to us. So we don't only learn about the early times. We actually learn about all the stuff in the way that those little light particles were hitting into. And so we actually learn a lot about stars and galaxies in between us and then. And so this is one of the revolutions in our field, is that this has opened up a whole area of understanding the physics of these objects with light that still comes from really early on, which is exciting.
This particular telescope, many people, when you mention the word telescope, think about a typical kind of instrument, that it's like a spyglass that Galileo used to look at the night sky. And they imagine that what astronomers are doing is they're looking through the observing end of this telescope. But this instrument that you're working on is not like that kind of telescope, is it?
One of the things that we should stress is that we have to make the telescope really, really cold. Because a normal, if you think of your camera, can operate at room temperature, but it's getting a lot of light. And then actually we want to measure this light from this early time, which is very, very, very cold. And so one of the technologies that we also develop is ways to make the telescope very cold. And turns out, I'm learning a lot from my colleagues this last couple of days, just learning about the ways in which we are innovating in that technology to try and cool down the telescope.
So our detectors see roughly everything that's warmer than them. They see not just the sky, but they also see elements of our telescope. And so we need to either remove that via filtering, or we need to remove that by cooling things down so that they're colder than what we're trying to look at, so that they don't contaminate that signal.
Are we talking refrigerator cold, freezer cold, dry cold. Ice cold, or?
So the temperature in this room is 300 Kelvin. The temperature of the cosmic background is around 3 Kelvin, where Kelvin is this weird temperature scale where zero is the coldest temperature you can actually have fundamentally, physically. And we want to get to just a hair's breadth warmer than the coldest thing you can be, which is why it's really difficult and takes a lot of incredible scientists to do.
Is there an absence of everything at zero? Is there an absence of light?
Yeah, I mean, so when we get there, I'll let you know.
Promise?
But that's one of the reasons why actually we don't sit in the telescope room. No one is actually sitting in the room. First of all, it's 17,000 feet above sea level, so you would need oxygen. We actually observe remotely, so the telescopes are controlled by computers that we spend a lot of time programming, and then we say to the telescope, move to this part of the sky and scan that part of the sky for, you know, 60 minutes, 100 minutes at a time. And so if we were there, we would just be like heating everything up and contaminating everything, which we don't want to do.
This gives new meaning to the phrase, your work is really cool.
Thanks, Dave.
I want to thank you in turn for joining us. And at this point, why don't you introduce each of you.
So I'm Jack Golowski-Scher. I'm a grad student at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm from New Brunswick, New Jersey, originally. I live here in Philadelphia now.
I'm Casey Wagoner. I'm a lecturer of physics at Princeton University.
I am Renee Hlojek. I'm an assistant professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the Dunlap Institute and the Department of Astronomy at the University of Toronto in Canada. But I'm originally from South Africa, where the skies are cool and upside down.
Derek Pitts, thank you so much for bringing this cohort in to try to make sense of a very early time in our history.
My pleasure, Dave. I'm very excited that this kind of work goes on, and specifically excited about the fact that so much of it, or a lot of it, is being done by people right here in the Delaware Valley. There's a tremendous amount of astronomy, intellectual horsepower here, and I think it's great if Philadelphians can know and share that information.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.